we're going to talk today about Jacob and Esau and their experiences that were quite varied. And at last, finally, they were able to make peace. So the narrative for this is, my other computer is still coming up. The narrative we're going to focus on largely is from Genesis, from chapter 25 and forward through chapter 35. We're going to deal with two parts of our lesson today, two lessons more or less on a spiritual or moral foundation, and two with a prophetic or symbolic meaning as pertains to the divine plan. And Esau, of course, was the firstborn. That is, although they were twins, he came out first. And Jacob, however, was different. Jacob was secondborn, but much more the person of faith. As you can see from the screen, the narrative about Jacob and Esau has a good ending. These twin brothers, once estranged for 20 years, at last reconciled. But they had a checkered history. Jacob and Esau were the twin sons of Isaac, who married rather late at the age of 40 to Rebekah, who then remained childless for 20 years and then bore twins, the only children that Isaac and Rebekah would have. Esau was born just ahead of Jacob, so he had the right of the firstborn, though his birth would have been only minutes before his brother at best. Though twins, Jacob and Esau were very different, both in appearance and in interests. Esau was robust, vigorous, but natural-minded. Jacob was gentle, thoughtful, and valued the promises of God that were his heritage through Abraham and Isaac. Jacob was a man of faith. Esau was not. As you recall the narrative in Genesis 25, once when Esau came in from hunting, weary and hungry, he sold his birthright to Jacob for a pot of stew, red in color, something Esau liked, and that color of that stew actually was the source for the name Edom, which means red, which was often used for Esau, kind of a reminder of what he valued and didn't value. Isaac loved Esau for his venison. I've always found that engaging. Isaac was a man of that had a natural affection for his firstborn. But Rebekah loved Jacob for his disposition. Now, you find that contrast not assumed or guessed at. You'll find it directly stated in Genesis 25:28. When in the elderly years of Isaac's life, it came due for him to bless his sons, unaware of the agreement between Jacob and Esau. Isaac thought to give Esau the blessing of the firstborn, but Rebekah evidently was aware of that agreement. Rebekah urged her favorite son to go in first and present himself as though he were Esau to his aged father Isaac, whose eyes had dimmed. Now, this brings us to the first of the two moral lessons that we'd like to begin our service with. It's a values lesson drawn from things that Jacob valued. What Jacob valued was heavenly promises and not temporal gain. Now, the right of the firstborn, of course, would include both, but Jacob's interest was not on the temporal like Esau, his brother, was. Jacob's interest was on the spiritual hopes of the heavenly promise. That is, the hopes that it maintained from heaven, from God. Jacob did labor. He worked with his herd and his flocks, and we labor to provide good things for our families and our requirements here. But Jacob's eye was always on the promises, and our eye should always be on the promises. When Jacob fled from the wrath of his brother, he took nothing. He gathered stones for a pillow, but he was not concerned. His eyes were not on temporal things. His eyes were on the promises of God. Now, you see before you one of the illustrations about Jacob when he had fled, and he fled really without anything except his vesture and maybe a little money in his pocket. But that night at Bethel, and that location is going to come up later in our discussion as well, God caused him to have a dream. And that dream was the dream that we call the dream of Jacob's ladder, although it probably wasn't a ladder at all, but a stairway, and the angels ascending and descending upon it. And Jesus commented on this in John 1:51 to give us the meaning. Jesus said, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, hereafter you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." So that ladder, or that stairway rather, really represents Jesus himself. Now, I think most of the brethren think of that as a kingdom picture, and that's good. But I think when Jesus mentioned this, he had in mind something more immediate. There are two ages of redemption, and in both of those ages of redemption, Jesus is our communication with the Heavenly Father from above. As Paul would say in Hebrews, he is our great high priest entered into the heavens. Sometimes Jacob did prosper materially. Sometimes he had almost nothing. But never was he distressed in either case. When Jacob fled his home, his family, his friends, he had what he cherished. And he knew he had that because Isaac had blessed him. Jacob was heir of God's promises. Brethren, you are heir of God's even richer promises. Always cherish that above everything else. God favored Jacob because of what Jacob valued. God favors you because of what you value. What you have, brethren, is above the value of rubies. You have treasure in heaven. If all of your life here crumbled, if your temporal circumstances turned to dust, you have boundless treasure waiting for you in God's due time. The promises that we have are more than we deserve. But Luke 12:33 says, "Provide for yourselves treasure in heaven that fails not." And verse 34, "Where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be." And Colossians 3:2, "Set your affection on things above, not on things of the earth." Brethren, if we value the things of God as Jacob did, we will be overcomers. The next experience, really it's an experience that happened before Jacob fled, but the one that, from which we want to take a moral lesson about integrity is the experience by which Jacob, although properly motivated, actually secured the blessing from his father Isaac. Now, you know the story. You know that there was deception here. You know that twice Jacob affirmed to his father Isaac, "I am Esau, thy firstborn," Genesis 27:19. And then again in verse 24, when Isaac had asked, because there was some doubt, "Are you my very son Esau?" And he replied, "I am." That was not correct. That was deception. Twice, Jacob came to realize that that deception was not proper. Once when Jacob had fled, and he worked for 7 years for his lovely bride, Rachel, he found out to his amazement in the morning that he was deceived. And in fact, he had Leah for wife. Now that's engaging because Jacob had deceived his father about the two brothers, which was which. And now Jacob is deceived about two sisters, which is which. And Jacob was twice reminded. That wasn't the only experience that brought this matter of his deception to mind. When you look in Genesis 32:26-28, we'll get to that experience later in another segment. But that's when Jacob was returning home after a long time, and he wrestled with an angel. And the angel said, "Let me go." And Jacob says, "I won't let you go until I get that blessing." and the day was breaking, and Jacob had wrestled a long time, but he would not let go. And the angel said, "Tell me your name." And of course he responded, "I am Jacob." And on that occasion, the angel said, "Your name will now be changed to Israel, the prince that has overcome." I can't help but think that Jacob would have remembered when he last affirmed his name, but this time correctly. Jacob twice deceived his father. He is twice reminded earnestly of that experience. Now, I think we're very forgiving of Jacob, but was Jacob justified? He was not. It was understandable, perhaps, but not justified. You know, that's the way it is with us. We have a lot of things that we do that aren't really right. God understands. It may be understandable, but never be deceived that it actually is right. Still, God blessed Jacob, as with a dream when Jacob fled, a ladder reaching to heaven. What should Jacob have done? I mean, after all, you know that right from the beginning, when his mother Rebecca was pregnant with twins and they were tussling inside her womb as she perceived it, she heard from the Heavenly Father, I presume by a dream, the elder will serve the younger. Now, Rebecca knew that. She knew that was destined. That's no doubt why she told her son to dress as the firstborn and go in and get that blessing. She knew it was God's overruling providence. So it was right that God had planned that Jacob would have the right of the firstborn. But what could he have done differently? Well, he might have approached his mother and said, "Mom, let's go to my father, Isaac, your husband, and let's explain to him the situation. Let's tell him about the agreement that we made, that I made with my brother Esau, who didn't care about the birthright. And let's explain perhaps to Father Isaac that my interest is not temporal. It's in the promises of God that God had given to Abraham and Isaac. And see whether Isaac might be able to, before blessing either of us, distinguish and give me the spiritual blessing that my brother doesn't care for and give him the temporal blessing that he's earnest for." Now, how would that have worked? I don't know. We don't know because it wasn't tried. But I suggest that would have been at least a method. And then, because Jacob was a man of faith, to exercise faith that God would overrule the issue properly. Now, there's a lot of things that come up in our life. We are heirs to heavenly treasure. We want to earnestly focus on our heavenly treasure. But we want to do it honorably, not deceptively, and not bending the rules of what is right, good, proper, and decent. Even if we have an earnestly desired objective, we have to conduct ourselves with integrity, always the way Jesus would have done. Always be honest, especially in the important things, especially in spiritual things. It may not always be pleasant near term. It is always best. The things we have to do with spiritually are too important. Now we're going to move on to a pair of symbolic prophetic lessons. We're going back in time a little bit to the experience when Jacob supplanted Esau. And we're going to look at what this might picture symbolically or spiritually. Now, I think that this really refers to the fact that Jacob represents the church who is going to supplant natural Israel as the chief heir of God's chief spiritual blessings. Now, there on the screen, you'll see Genesis 25:26 referred to in blue, and that describes the time when Esau and Jacob were being born. Esau came out first, but when he did, you saw the little hand of Jacob grabbing onto the heel of Jacob, the heel of his brother Esau. That actually is what the word Jacob means, Strong's 3290. It really means heel. But in a sense, it's said to be supplanter because grabbing onto the heel was as though to indicate, I'm going to take what is his right. I'm going to get the birthright. So Jacob is really named after the word heel, but with a concept of supplanter. Now, Jacob had said, sell me this day thy birthright. That's Genesis 25:31. And Esau agreed. But that wasn't adequate. Then Jacob said, swear to me this day. And he swore and sold his birthright unto Jacob. And he went about eating his meal. And he left without any concern. That shows the spirit. That shows the interest that Esau really had. And in a way, that kind of characterizes natural Israel. Esau was not a necessarily bad person. As a matter of fact, Esau married a Canaanite, and when he saw that that really wasn't pleasing to his father, he actually went out of his way to marry another woman that was related to the family because he saw what Isaac preferred. So Esau was not really a bad person, but he was not a spiritual person. Natural Israel was not spiritually minded. Now, those that were heard the message of truth that Jesus gave, and they followed and they went onward and upward into the heavenly calling. But as a body, Israel was rejected. Jacob's supplanting Israel, I think, refers to the church supplanting natural Israel. Now, in this deception, in the way that Jacob received the birthright and his privileges spiritually, although he fled and forsook the natural part, there were the parts of the deception that seemed to have symbolic meaning. First of all, Rebecca, you can see there in the image there, be on guard lest Esau come quickly. She first of all told her son Jacob in Genesis 27:15, put on a garment from your brother. And I think a garment represents sometimes spiritually our privileges, our standing before God. Now, you know, we want to be dressed in the white robes of the righteousness of Christ. When the bride in Revelation 19 is adorned with a fine linen, which is the righteousness of saints, that's what we look forward to. Well, Israel had a certain standing before God too. And that was really taken by the church. All the heavenly blessings, all the best blessings, all of that standing really was transferred to the church. In addition to that, Rebecca said, because your brother is a hairy man and you're pretty smooth, take the skin of a kid of the goats. That's Genesis 27:16, and put it on your neck and on your hands. Now, I don't know Hebrew well enough to know if that's distinct hands as opposed to arms. In the illustration, it looks like it's on his arms. But the way I have figured in my mind, probably he's wearing long sleeves and his hands are exposed, but it does say hand if the Hebrew translation is done properly there. Whatever it was, when Isaac, knowing that he was dim of vision, when Isaac had his son before him, he said, well, your voice sounds like Jacob, but he felt his skin and he said, no, you feel like Esau. That skin of the goats, I think, is symbolically identifying Jacob here as a picture of the gospel age church. Now, you may remember in the tabernacle in the wilderness that over the tabernacle, there were four coverings. There was the fine linen, first of all, that was two parts of five. Five is a new creation, that five linen, the righteousness of saints, and the hope of glory because it was woven with all kinds of colorful designs. I think those two parts of that linen covering represents Jesus, the master of the new creation, and the rest of the church, his body, the 144,000 class, the two parts of the new creation. But over that, there was 11 strips of goat hair curtain, two parts, five strips and six strips. Perhaps suggesting the church in the flesh during the gospel age. The five shows that they are part of the new creation, but the six shows that they still have sin within them. Well, if that's true, if that represents the church, and that was a kid of the goats, hair, curtain, I think that identifies with the spiritual hope of Jacob here in this case. Now, over that, because that was five and six is sin, we're still in sinful flesh, we had one more covering, a ram skin dyed red. Rams, like the ram caught in the thicket, picture of our Lord's redemption, the ransom, red, his sacrifice. That's our covering for our old flesh. Even though we're we're in the flesh, we're accepted. We're accepted because we have that covering of the ransom applied for us. And then over that, the fourth covering, very unattractive, the flesh as the world sees it. So the skin of the kid of the goats, I think perhaps identifies Jacob here spiritually. Beyond that, you all know Leviticus 16. The kid of the goats there, we commonly say, is a picture of the church and their sacrifice during the gospel age, which identifies well here as well. Now, there's another case where there were twins, where it represented very similar to what's represented with Esau and Isaac. You'll find that in Genesis chapter 38. It's with Judah. Now, you know that Judah was the tribe from which Jesus ultimately would come. So this experience in Genesis 38 is really about Jesus and how the sons, the inheritors of Jesus, would develop. And it says that he married this lady, and they had three sons, Ur and Onan and Shelah. And then it says Ur was wicked and God slew him. And then Onan was to raise up child, as was the levirate law to his fallen brother. And at the critical moment, he refused. And so God slew him. And Shelah was just too young at the time. He had to wait for some years. So Ur and Onan, I think, represent the nation of Israel, the ones that had the opportunity to be the spiritual seed of Abraham and the ones that had the opportunity to be the church of Christ. Ur, Israel, at the time of Babylon, lost their national status because they were disobedient. They could have raised up seed to his fallen brother at the time Jesus arrived, but they also perished at the hands this time of the Roman Empire. And the rest of Israel, they had to mature. They had to mature for some time before they could really be brought back into the picture. First Chronicles 4, verse 21, we finally find out what happened to Shelah. Years later, he missed the prize of the high calling, figuratively. But later on, he was the father of those that wrought in fine linen. And that's what Israel's going to do in the kingdom. They're going to rot fine linen, and they're going to close the world of mankind with justification and fine linen. Now, another picture of Elisha in the kingdom. When a woman with two sons, and they're ready to go captive, and they need money to prevent the captivity. And she says, well, we'll give you some money. Here's what you have to do to redeem yourself. You have to fill all these vessels full of oil. And that also is a picture of Israel's service in the kingdom. They're going to fill the vessels of mankind with oil by example, by ministry, by help, by devotion, under the tutelage of the ancient worthies, of course. That's what Shelah finally is going to do. So Ur and Onan, they didn't turn out well. So how was the spiritual seed developed? It turned out that Judah at that point was deceived into having children by Tamar. Tamar was the wife of one of those deceased boys. And she brought forth twins, Phares, which means breach, and Zerah, which is seed. Zerah was supposed to be the firstborn. He put his finger out at birth. They wrapped a scarlet cord around it. But then he pulled it back, and Phares came out before him. These are twins, just like Jacob and Esau. It means the same thing. The one destined for that redemption and that heavenly call pulled back. And Phares came out first. There's the breach. Zerah, by the way, means seed. That was the destined seed of Abraham, Israel. But they pulled back. And Phares came out in the breach. He accepted that. And as you might surmise, through Judah, it was through Phares that finally Jesus, our Redeemer, came. Jacob, in the sense that he supplants Esau, is a picture of spiritual Israel as opposed to natural Israel. But now we're going to change it a little bit. That's the way it is, you know, with a lovely gem. You take a little prism. You take a cut gem, you look at it in the sunlight in a different way, a little different reflection. You're going to get a little different image. And we're going to get a different image from the life of Jacob in the next situation. As distinguished from Isaac, Jacob really represents the natural as opposed to the spiritual. Now, you're all familiar with the fact that God told Abraham, your seed will be as the stars of heaven. Now, you'll find that in Genesis 15. And if you look in verses 1 through 5, you'll find that the subject at hand was the coming birth of Isaac. So when Isaac was the subject in Genesis 15, 1 through 5, God promised Abraham, your seed will be as the stars. That's what Isaac represents, the star class, Christ, head and body. Galatians 3:16, thy seed, which is Christ. Galatians 3:29, if you be Christ's, then you're Abraham's seed. And there's according to the promise. You, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of the promise. And now in Genesis 26:4, when Abraham had died and God appeared to Isaac to repeat the covenant, he told Isaac, your seed will be like the stars of heaven. Isaac is spiritual. Now, when Abraham was sacrificing Isaac, on that occasion, when Isaac was lifted from the altar and the ram killed instead, that represents Jesus giving his life for a ransom. Abraham there represents God offering his son for the redemption of the world. And in that case, the broadest scope of the Abrahamic promise of all was promised. Your seed will be like the stars of heaven and as the sand of the seashore, because there's two ages of redemption that this ransom will apply to. The star class during the gospel age and the whole world of mankind, the sands of the seashore in the millennial age. But when God appeared to Jacob in 28:14, Genesis 28:14, he didn't say stars and he didn't say sand of the seashore. He said, your seed will be like the dust of the earth. Earthly, not spiritual. In this case, Jacob, as distinguished from Isaac, represents natural Israel as opposed to spiritual Israel. But a little step above the sand of the seashore, more terra firma, as it were, Israel's going to be a little step ahead of the world of mankind. And if you go back to Genesis 13, 15, and 16, where God told Abraham about his earthly possession, the land that you can see that's going to be yours, that's going to be Israel's. And on that occasion, God told Abraham, your seed will be, you can guess it, the dust of the earth, because that's about natural Israel. Now, we're going to go on to another segment, our last main segment, and that is Jacob, when he had fled from his brother Esau, and he was away for 20 years. And he went to the land of Haran, into an area called Padan Aram, and he was there for 20 years. Now, I think that 20 years has some meaning for us. I think 20 is representing, in this case, the period of the gospel age. And that Jacob fleeing the land is actually a picture of natural Israel who had to leave the land that was promised to them and for the period of the gospel age be outside the land. Now, Jacob was productive during that time, and he never forgot the promises. Now, he does represent natural Israel in this case, but God blessed him even in the wilderness, even in Paran, I shouldn't say the wilderness. Even in this situation, God did bless him. Now, you remember by contrast that Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac was born. But when Jacob and Esau were born, Isaac was 60 years old, earthly, temporal, instead of the 100, which is Jesus' spiritual number. We'll see, run into that number again a little bit later. Okay, we're going to go on a little bit farther. You can see some names on the screen, but you can't read them. They're too small. So on the next image, we're going to accentuate those names. And we're going to look at the time when Jacob finally returned to the land of promise, which would be our day in history. Jacob is returning after 20 years. Now, I'd like to explain more why 20 is a picture of the gospel age, but our time is lapsing, so I'm going to skip over that part. But Jacob received a dream from God that told him it was time to return. And may I say that the Israelites are back in the land today because God, through prophecies and stirring of people, and through his providential overruling, has indicated it's time to go back to the land. So he left, he came, and in Genesis this is chapters 31 through 35 for this whole passage. 31, Jacob told his wives of what God had said and that they're going to do, and they agreed. There was a confrontation. We'll have to pass by that. But finally, in chapter 32 of Genesis, Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. Now, he's approaching the Holy Land, really in the Holy Land at this point. Now, this word, this expression, the angels of God met him, is remarkable. Only two verses, but it's a stunning situation. Verse 2, when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's host. And he called the name of that place Mahanaim, which means two hosts or camps. It wasn't just an angel or two. It was two camps of angels. This was really an encouragement to Jacob. How could it be otherwise? And I think this indicates God's providential care and overruling for the people of Israel now that they are coming back to the land. That is where Jacob wrestled with an angel all night. And Israel is wrestling right now. They're wrestling because they know they need peace with their brother Esau. So Jacob sent droves and droves and droves of animals. The numbers are meaningful, but we have to pass over that. And finally, they tenderized the heart of Esau, who was coming with 400 armed men. You don't need 400 armed men to say hello. And I think that tells you Esau had vengeance on his mind, but his heart was tenderized. And may I say that Israel has tenderized the hearts of many of their Arab nations today. The Abraham Accords are testimony to that fact. Now, I think that in the prophecies about Israel, I think that Joel 1:4 is a little hint to us that there are four conflicts that Israel has to pass through before the kingdom is established. Can't talk about them too much, but I would just say the first one, I think, is 1948. The next one, 1967. The next, 1973. And you know, it's been 48 years since we've had a war, but you know one's coming. That last one is Ezekiel 38. But in that war, no Semitic enemies of Israel are part of the coalition. I don't think the Arabs are going to fight Israel again. I think we're beyond that point. Well, they embraced at sunrise, and I think that shows when the sunrise of the new kingdom dawns, not dawns, dawn is before sunrise, when sunrise breaks and the ancient worthies are back, those that respect Abraham are going to agree, appreciate, and be at peace. Got to go on. They left Penuel. Esau returned. Jacob went forward, and he went to a city called Succoth. Now, this word Succoth means tabernacle. The Feast of Tabernacles, that's the Feast of Succoth in Hebrews, in the Hebrew language. That suggests symbolically the beginning of Christ's kingdom, the seven-day feast of the Feast of Tabernacles. But now they cross the Jordan and they come into another area where they have more contact with the Christian world. At Shechem, Jacob buys in to the land of Shechem. Now, Shechem, I believe, represents the host of Christendom. And this is the time when Israel is going to buy into the Christian doctrine that Jesus really was the Messiah. And he bought it for the price that Jesus is often reckoned as, 100. It was 100 pieces of silver in King James. But if you look in the margin, it says 100 lambs of silver. They buy into the identity that Jesus was Messiah. And then they move on. I can't tell you everything that happened to Shechem. Our clock is running. They go on to Bethel. And at Bethel, this is where Jacob had received his vision earlier, that the promises would be sure to him. And this is a reminder that the promises are sure. And at Bethel, Deborah, the nurse of Rebecca, died. The nurse of Rachel, excuse me. I'm a little hesitant there. Deborah, the nurse, died. And I believe that that represents the end of the role of the ancient worthies as ministers to us, as nursemaids to us, as nursemaids to the spiritual class, because the ancient worthies now have another role. They move on to Bethlehem. And at Bethlehem is where Rachel delivered her last child, Benjamin, and she died in the process. Rachel, of course, represents the spiritual covenant and the last child of the spiritual covenant is Benjamin. And Benjamin represents the great company board at this time. They go on to Hebron, where Isaac was, and now we have a record of the death of Isaac, representing that Jesus' role for the gospel age has now been finished. His age of 180, tying in symbolically to the Gentiles. Now, we got only a little more to go. Maybe the chairman would be patient with me here just a little bit. After this, in Genesis chapter 35, we have a list of all of the 12 sons. The six sons of Leah are represented first, I believe, just like the six sons of Keturah. This represents the world of mankind, ready for their blessing in the kingdom. Her handmaid had two children, Gad and Asher, representing that the world of mankind will be large in number and very happy, which is what those two names mean. Then Rachel's sons are listed, Joseph and Benjamin, the church and the great company. And then her handmaid, those that lost the privilege of spiritual life. Dan, who drew back and was unfaithful. And Naphtali, that means wrestling, which identifies with Jacob's wrestling, natural Israel, who had the privilege of the high calling, but drew back and lost that opportunity. So there's all the classes of the kingdom all laid out for us. And finally, our summary. We should value our heavenly promises. Jacob did. Jacob was a man of faith. That should characterize each one of us, from the least of us to the greatest. From the least of us to the Apostle Paul, faith has to be the marking characteristic of our walk before God. Through discouragements, difficulties, despair, never let hold of the cord of faith. It can happen. Don't let it happen. Go to God in prayer. Honesty, especially in our faith. Integrity is paramount if we wish to be people of truth. Speaking of moral truth. The church, I think, was what Jacob pictured insofar as he supplanted Esau, but natural Israel insofar as he is distinguished from Isaac. Dear brethren, we have a wonderful prospect. Esau and Jacob have not yet embraced, but they will. They'll do that at the break of the day. And then, the wonderful kingdom of righteousness will not only deal with those that have had faith, but will extend to every man, woman, and child who has ever lived. God be praised. Thank you.